Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Americanization of the Apocalypse, Creating America's Own Bible, by Donald Harmon Akinson. Narrated by David Stifel. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. The migration of ideas. Where in the world did that come from? Is a question whose informality might obscure the fact that it is a smart query, a lot more useful than are most questions stated in academic language. In the history trade, it is one that we should ask more often, for it reminds us that no event or process or person can be analyzed purely as if it were an abstract entity. All human history needs at least two coordinates, time, of course, and place. A related, more pointed query concerning any belief, ideology, social custom, economic practice, or technological innovation is, how did that come to be here? The here in the question can be any place, your home today, or the Senate of the Roman Republic in classical times, or any place and time that is amenable to historical analysis. Although we rarely speak of our trade this way, I think most shrewd historical analysis is essentially migration history, not simply the movement of individuals, tribes, and social groups from one place to another, although that certainly is a fundamental historical process, but also the migration of ideas and technologies and customs and habits from one culture to another. Often in big history, suites of ideas and complexes of behavior seem to have traveled from one continent to another without the aid of much human migration, as if they were fully formed icebergs traversing big patches of ocean. The helpful characteristic of all these migration histories, whether of corporeal individuals or of constellations of ideas, is that when taken together, they help us to avoid the implicit and often unintentional vainglory of mere locality. Of course, every town, province, and nation has its own unique physical geography and cultural topography, and these at several levels are formative of events within the local boundaries. Yet in any given jurisdiction, most of what happens, most of what is believed, is an adaptation of ideas and behaviors that came from someplace else. That's just the way the world works. No town, state, or nation is autochthonous, however loudly its propagandists may declare it to be mystically and morally exceptional, or however elegantly its historians play a game of intellectual squash rackets, with the patterns of cause and effect being limited to the whitewashed walls of the locality or nation. Theologians of the Catholic Church have developed a concept, enculturation, that can be secularized to help our understanding of the way that a small collection of individuals living on the edge of Europe embraced a new concept of Christianity, virtually a new religion, some would say. And eventually this faith came to define the prepotent form of Protestantism in the United States, and thus to be a strong component of everyday American culture. Enculturation, though a theologically complex concept concerning the dynamic relationship of belief and culture, can, for our purposes, be simplified to identify operationally the following stages of interaction: the definition of a boundaried belief system within a given culture, the transfer of that suite of beliefs and practices from one culture into another, the modification of the form, and however much it might offend the purists, and the content of the original system, so that the recipient culture embeds the new material into one of its own existing belief systems. The continued change in the way the recipient culture thinks and acts in its everyday life, consequent upon its embrace of the new ideas. Simultaneously, the modification of the imported suite of ideas and behaviors that results from the daily rubbing against the local society continues. And finally, there occurs the attempt to re-evangelize the now slightly askew recipient culture by purists who conclude that things have gone somewhat astray. The present study is a standalone item. It is also the third volume in my study of a big piece of migration history, the passage of a radically new form of Christianity that in the early 19th century was created, invented, discovered, or rediscovered. Every word one can use will raise someone's hackles. In the drawing rooms of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy and gentry of County Wicklow and South County Dublin to England, and thence first to the Canadas, and then southwards to the great U.S. cities situated along the St. Lawrence watershed. The previous volumes are Discovering the End of Time, Irish Evangelicals in the Age of Daniel O'Connell, 2016, and Exporting the Rapture, John Nelson Darby and the Victorian Conquest of North American Evangelicalism, 2018. The scholarly listener should look at the bibliographic conventions that are set down in the first volume. They are my suggestions as to the most convenient and reliable way to deal with a large chunk of the literature on early millennial apocalypticism, that produced in several million words by John Nelson Darby, which tumbled into print in a confusing welter of editions, fascicules, and reprints. Also, because this volume mostly deals with events from the mid-19th century and onwards, I have necessarily compressed the earlier history. For those who wish to go further into the early story, and also to those who wish to check my documentation, references to the previous volumes in this study are provided. The pivot of the story, but emphatically only a part of the narrative, is the religious community often referred to as the Plymouth Brethren. It was they who were chiefly responsible for slingshotting some loose but very attractive front-edge new ideas from the British Isles to North America. They did so by engaging the intermediate step of packaging the theological faith innovations of the British Isles of the 1820s and 1830s into a single ideational bundle that could be transported efficiently, like a voyager's pack of trade goods, across great distances and difficult climes. The 19th century Brethren have long been under-recognized historically, and for good reason. They are devilishly hard to deal with historically because they were secretive, albeit without any apparent joy in their obscurity. They simply focused on their faith. They kept no corporate institutional records. They refused to admit they were an organization in any public sense. And indeed, until the last quarter of the 19th century, they did not even have address lists of compatible assemblies of the faithful. Most of their adherents did not much like having any distinctive name, preferring just to be called Christians, Brethren, Church of God, or some other blurred term. In practice, after a seismic schism in the late 1840s, it was common to refer to the two main branches as Open Brethren and Exclusive Brethren. That practice is adopted here, with the full knowledge that there were other terms employed at the time, and still others adopted since then by their theological descendants. By the late 19th century, many Brethren in the British Isles and North America were willing to be referred to by outsiders as Plymouth Brethren. The term at least had a false patina of Mayflower Pilgrim ancestry, even though they usually would have used a different name among themselves. The real problem with the Brethren as an active force in the enculturation of apocalyptic millennialism into the evangelical sector of the English-speaking world is simply that they were so vivid in retailing their faith, by small, intense meetings, and paradoxically, by a massive publishing program. and yet were so very secretive about the operational details of their faith community. The Brethren developed a highly distinctive faith system. At a high level of generality, their beliefs had three sharply distinctive features, as well as several others that were unusual, but not quite so remarkable. Of the three, one made no nevermind outside of their own faith world, but two had an especially strong impact in North America. The one that was rarely adopted by religious leaders outside their own camp was the Brethren's insistence on a totally lay ministry. To make the precept even less palatable, the lay-only practice was situated in an organizational structure that was distinctive for being declared to outsiders as being non-existent. Such an ecclesiology was not quite the thing for attracting Protestant pastors from existing denominational congregations. In contrast, secondly, the Brethren invented an attractive new hermeneutic, a way of reading the Old and New Testaments that merged an obeisance to the original intent of the Scriptures with a belief that the secret meaning hidden within the Bible could be decrypted. The Brethren were hardly the first faith group to claim to have broken open the true meaning of the Scriptures. The radically new trick was to declare that the Scriptures should be divided according to those that were intended for Israel and those for the Church. This cleavage did not correspond to the long-held line between the Old and New Testaments, and had to be learned from the Brethren's hermeneutical adepts. It is possible to argue that, effectively, the Brethren created an entirely new set of Scriptures. So radical was their recompiling and reinterpreting of the ancient texts. Thirdly, the Brethren developed a form of apocalyptic millennialism that was markedly different from the various end-of-time scenarios that were being affirmed elsewhere in the Western world. The details are complicated, but students of evangelical eschatology will quickly note that the Brethren were the chief retailers of a singular form of premillennial eschatology. The Chief Brethren scheme, there were minority versions of the pattern, was that Jesus would return in the physical form that he possessed when he was previously on earth, and would take his people heavenwards, the rapture. Thereafter, for those left behind, there would be a period of writhing pain on earth, the tribulation, and then Jesus would reappear to clean up the mess and to reign for 1,000 years with his saints and with the holy remnant of the Jewish people, who now were restored to sovereignty over their promised land. Finally, there would be a splendidly pyrotechnic final judgment of all of history's unsaved souls, and the Almighty would replace human time with an infinite skein of divine rule. A complicated and not easily parsed theology. Its God is in its details. That so much of the system was enculturated into sectors of American Protestantism is surprising. Still, before the first decade of the 20th century had passed, the radical apocalypticism of the Irish drawing rooms had been adopted and reshaped to form one of the foundational elements of modern American evangelicalism. Not all branches, but even those that rejected it had to consider its tenets. Like so much of the master narrative of the millennia-long Christian diaspora, this smaller story is that of a long march along the path of improbability. It occurred. It deserves our attention. Part 1. Geography Counts. Chapter 1. Ireland. Not the Garden of Eden. The Historical Literature on Religion. The historical literature on religion and its social and ideological offshoots in the United States from the 19th through the 20th centuries is the richest of any country in the self-declared First World. The bibliodensity is at once amazing and daunting. That is the way it should be. The United States in the present era, say from World War II onwards, has been the most religious of the economically highly developed nations, and it has every right to know about its parentage. Yet paradoxically, the strength of American religious historiography is a good reason to put it aside for a time, at least if one is looking for distinctive threads that help to explain why the narrative of American religious history has taken some intriguing and unexpected turns. The wattage of the U.S. national historiography is so great that it is hard to see tiny flashes on the horizon, emanations from distant solar systems that, when they are assessed, are found to have had strong gravitational fields that have directly influenced American beliefs and events. Take Ireland. It is not controversial to note that in the second half of the 19th century, which is to say after the Great Famine, and until roughly the mid-20th century, the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland was the single most influential national church in the Catholic world. This occurred by virtue of the homelands undergoing a devotional revolution that turned the populace into a strongly disciplined worshiping community, which was combined with a large and continuous outflow of the general population. The Irish Catholic Church became a missionary church, surfing on the bow waves of the Second British Empire and upon that of the emerging American Empire. The mission church had a dual purpose: to serve European Catholics, especially but not solely the Irish, who migrated to the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and more, and less pressingly, to convert indigenous populations, particularly in the portions of Africa conquered by European states. Well into the middle of the 20th century, the middle and upper management of the church in America was either born in Ireland or was of Irish ethnicity. What is much less well known, and doubtlessly is more controversial, is the assertion that the Protestant minority in Ireland in the 19th century had a significant general influence upon American religious developments, and among evangelicals, a formative one. Here one must pay tribute to Ernest Sandeen's pioneering classic, Roots of Fundamentalism, British and American Millenarianism, 1800 to 1930, Chicago, University of Chicago Press, 1970, a volume that has been underappreciated. Among the differences between the Irish Catholic Church and the Irish Protestant faiths as they impacted American life in the later 19th and early 20th centuries, a key dissonance was less a matter of theology than it was of tone. The Catholic Church's march was that of a church triumphant. That of the Irish Protestants often smacked of the church despondent. The Catholic message to the first and second generation immigrants was that by God's grace, things would turn out all right. The world would not end. Those Protestants who were deep in apocalyptic doom casting seemed to suggest that by God's grace, everything would turn out all right, for the world indeed would end. Among a very narrow band of Irish Anglicans, to use an anachronistic term, they were adherents of the Church of Ireland, the State Church. A deeply pessimistic form of evangelical Protestantism evolved in the 1820s and 1830s. This actually is not surprising, for the doctrinal innovations of this small Anglo-Irish cohort were indirect descriptors of their everyday world, which in their view was racing to hell very quickly. They created a faith that was immediately pessimistic. The actual physical world would end quite nastily, and rather soon. But if one chose to look at the end of human history as a good thing, their faith was ultimately optimistic, since eventually God would rule forever. Most emphatically, in my describing an imposingly complex set of historical events in such a summary fashion, I do not wish to be misread. I do not believe that there was a merely mechanical relationship between the social pressures on the Anglo-Irish Protestants and the formulation by a few of their number of a new religious system. Of course, one pays attention to their social and political situation. In this case, one notes the particular importance of the innovators, geographic location, and their self-perception of vulnerability. But equally, we need to appreciate that the qualities of their new faith were not merely analgesic. Something beyond simple social compensation took place, and a new, full, and very persuasive ideational system emerged. Here is the situation in the early 19th century. Ireland in general was a sour place, with too many moral debts falling due at the same time. The largest of these, affecting all branches of Irish society, was the mortmain of a form of colonialism that had reached its apogee, if one may use such a term, in the late 17th to mid-18th centuries. This was a national form of imperialism, the British, meaning English and Scots, subduing the Irish. But for our purposes, its mode of articulation is the crucial point. It was the subordination by force of the Irish Catholics in a Protestant imperium, whose foot soldiers were not temporary invaders, but long-term colonists. At a fairly high level of abstraction, one can view the Protestant-Catholic fissure as simply the Irish version of the rash of European wars that had raged since the Reformation. But on the ground, the vitriol was anything but abstract. The signature of Protestant overlordship in the early and mid-18th century was the so-called Penal Code. This was not really a legal code, but rather an overlapping snarl of statutes that deprived Catholics of most civil rights, subsumed a large proportion of their landholdings, attempted to break their cultural identity, and both directly and indirectly penalized the Catholic faith. Even by European standards of sectarian government, the Irish Penal Code was striking. In the case of European countries, the government, representing a majority religion, persecuted a minority. In Ireland, a minority drove down the majority. Between 1782 and 1793, most of the Penal Code, but not the Protestant subsumption of Catholic land, was erased, in part because of a political climate that temporarily favored liberal ideas, and in part because of the successful revolution in the American colonies, which suggested that excessive government force applied to a civilian population could be disastrous. This reforming period later was nostalgically recalled as the Golden Age of the Irish Protestant nation, and that was accurate, at least in the sense that only Protestants were allowed to sit in the Irish Parliament and to hold the highest executive posts. Crucially, for later events, even after the period of late 18th century reforms, Catholic emancipation, the right to sit in Parliament, still was not granted. Sectarianism, deeply etched on both sides of the religious divide, was a sin that could not be quickly shriven. The liberal period, seemingly only a moment, ended in the mid-1790s, when a nationalist movement in Ireland coalesced. It overlapped with the British-French War, and in 1797 to 1799 morphed into an Irish sectarian civil war. That civil conflict was particularly strong in the counties of Southern Ireland, adjacent to the sites where the new Protestant evangelicalism soon was to emerge. As a tactical move to maintain imperial control over Ireland, the British and Irish parliaments were merged in 1801, and Ireland became a mere geographic designation, no longer a nation-state. Ireland, now a subset of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, lost its parliament. Dublin no longer was a capital city, but rather a provincial administrative center. The influence of Irish MPs, Irish bishops of the established church, and the holders of Irish titles of nobility all were reduced in the new Westminster Parliament. From the viewpoint of the Anglo-Irish ruling class, a failed but inconvenient rebellion in 1803 in Dublin and Wicklow was a cruel veneer of ill fortune. Not as cruel, however, as that visited on the lower classes in a series of epidemics and in a partial potato famine in 1821 to 1822. Ireland, indeed, was a sour place. Yet, in this diminished world, if one were the right sort of person, which is to say a large landowner, Church of Ireland, Anglican, well-born, and male, there was no doubt where in Ireland it was least unpleasant to live, and actually pleasant enough. County Wicklow and South County Dublin, including a slice of the classier parts of the city of Dublin, south of the Liffey. Consider County Wicklow. Of the county's total population of 121,500, nearly 22% was Anglican, as high as any county outside of Ulster. Nationally, Anglicans comprised about 10% of the population. This was enough to buffer against the Catholic majority. Although Dublin no longer was a national capital, the landlords of the posh parts of Wicklow and South Dublin had the advantage of possessing, usually, both a carefully landscaped country estate, with views of the Irish Sea, or of sculpted vistas of mountains and watercourses, and a townhouse in Dublin. Most of the landlord and upper gentry were resident for a large portion of the year. The names of the leading families one associates with the county are Guinness, Parnell, Synge, who provided a whole platoon of Irish bishops, Beresford, Marquesses of Waterford, and more Irish bishops, Hill, the Downshire Marquisate, Latouche, Huguenots who were the Rothschilds of Ireland, Proby, Earls of Carisfort, and Wingfield, Viscounts Powerscourt. Their estates in County Wicklow ran from 1,000 acres, most also had landholdings elsewhere in Ireland, to upwards of 50,000 acres. Within the coterie of these and similar families, and from somewhat less grand, but still solid gentry, the original Brethren movement began, and therefrom arose a radically new form of evangelicalism. In the first three decades of the 19th century, it became fashionable for many of the social elite in Ireland, not the majority, but a large number, to become spiritually earnest. This phenomenon was especially strong in the Wicklow, South Dublin area. Why this occurred does not admit of any easy explanation, but the reality of the phenomenon is not in doubt. Sometimes the new earnestness took the form of strict or exact churchmanship, embracing sacramental and liturgical formalism, and other times the contemporary Irish form of Anglican evangelicalism prevailed. Indeed, these two ways of becoming serious about the Anglican faith were not mutually exclusive, and one finds individuals, both lay persons and clerics, engaging in the devotional exercises that are, in the English context, often termed high church, and at the same time studying the scriptures and experiencing conversion in a manner usually associated with evangelicalism. Here, in discussing Irish Anglican evangelicalism in the first quarter of the 19th century, one can be gratefully aware of David Bebbington's classic conspectus of evangelicalism, Conversionism, Crucicentrism, Biblicism, Activism, and still point out that the Irish were a little different from the generality from which Bebbington draws his constellation of characteristics. The Irish evangelicals in this early period tended to operate at a cooler temperature. Their conversions often occurred slowly and bit by bit, but were no less real for that. The churchmen, both lay and professional, often were very learned in class.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?